Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what might the 2016 election mean for the future on climate, the economy, foreign policy, and democracy in the U.S.? But first, the makings of a scandal. Why are some perceived as big scandals while a rash of other wrongs are ignored? We're joined by Robert Entman. He's a professor of media and public affairs and professor of international affairs at the George Washington University. He is author of Scandal and Silence, Media Responses to Presidential Misconduct, Projections of Power, Framing News, Public Opinion, and U.S. Foreign Policy, and The Black Image in the White Mind, Media and Race in America. Well, welcome back to the Scholar's Circle, Robert Entman. It's great to have you back here with us.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
I wonder if we should first talk about generally how the media handled the 2016 election. What's your assessment?
You know, it has to be preliminary, but my general assessment is they did perhaps a worse job than ever, which is, you know, kind of hard to believe in some senses. By that, I mean, and I'm talking about the mainstream media, and we do have to talk about the other media, but in the mainstream media, as far as I could tell, and I think this is backed up by Tom Patterson's research at Harvard on the coverage, it's even more of an overwhelming focus on the horse race and tiny amounts of attention to policy issues. So that's one critique I would have. And I believe the figure I heard was that on the three major broadcast networks, there were 32 minutes of attention to policy issues and 100 minutes of coverage on Hillary Clinton's emails. That's an astonishing figure that speaks to real problems with mainstream media operations, particularly given all the critiques that we scholars have made over 30 or 40 years of that focus on the horse race. Second thing that we can say is that in doing the horse race coverage, they did a terrible job on that because they did not pick up all the uncertainty that ultimately led to Trump's winning the Electoral College. Now, I do like to always say he didn't win the election. The election was won by Hillary Clinton by over 1 million votes. But in America's somewhat peculiar system, or I should say quite peculiar system with the Electoral College, that's obviously where he won the election. And that distinction should have been probed better by the media and the currents that expressed themselves in the surprise outcome. So they did a bad job on that. Third, the way they handle scandals was itself scandalous, I would say. I just mentioned the emails, and we can get into that, but what's most troubling, it seems to me, is the failure to follow up the numerous individual reports on many, many Trump scandals. The only one that really got attention was, and this is predictable, the one where they had this sort of interesting video and audio evidence about his sexual stuff. So once again, you know, the sexual scandals are the ones that they love. I think one of the many, many mistakes the Clinton campaign made was focusing too much on that.
It's interesting about the Trump scandals. One of the things that I started to think about, and this is not reflected in the scholarship, is that there were so many of them that they got lost. Whereas with Hillary Clinton, there was a single thing to focus on and they could just repeat it and repeat it. And it became this sort of meta narrative.
Exactly. With some help from Trump, who gave them some memes, and I would say some help from Hillary in the sense that aside from the, you know, sexual stuff, Clinton barely mentioned any of the other things that she could have seized on. And if the opposition doesn't seize on it, of course, the candidate who has the scandals is not going to talk about them voluntarily. So by the bad strategic decisions, Hillary didn't feed the media's possible focus on the many, many things that came up with him. Is it a scandal that he didn't release his tax returns? Well, probably he's hiding things, and I haven't done the research, but it wouldn't surprise me if there was more attention to Mitt Romney's releasing his tax returns partially and some of the stuff that was indicated there than there was to Trump's non-release.
I was thinking that whole when they go low, you go high backfired on her.
I'm thinking of actually making that the title, or at least of a chapter in my new book. That is such a mistake. And it encapsulates the poor strategic thinking of, in general, the Democratic Party, and particularly the Clinton campaign.
As I understand it, that actually came from the Obamas.
Yes, and everyone loved it among, you know, many academics I know, and it's exactly the wrong thing.
You wrote a book, Scandal and Silence, about what is a scandal, what isn't a scandal, and really why it matters. We say we don't want to hear about scandals, but you think we should.
Although people may say they don't want to hear about scandals, in fact, they do. And that's one reason there is some attention sometimes to scandals, typically the ones that are easiest to understand and most sensational and typically about personal misbehavior. But why they're important is that's really the ultimate function of media in a democracy, is to keep the politicians and leaders honest. And we know that those folks, like any other human beings, are not necessarily automatically honest. And they're probably doing some things that are wrong and bad. And there really ought to be an eagerness to follow the evidence of misbehavior in office or in public life in some way. Journalists often congratulate themselves, always referring back to Watergate, as if Watergate was the typical scandal instead of the one example of a scandal that brought down a president, when in fact they don't typically follow up many, many important scandals. That was true in this campaign, where there was so little attention to really serious questions about Trump's business career, not just his personal life and temperament. It's been true, I think, largely for decades since Watergate. They got that one pretty right. But since then, and the book explains why, it's not so easy to go after scandals. Often they're very complicated. Often it takes a lot of time. And by the time you get the truth, it may be too late. Let's say in this case, the election already happened. You know, I certainly grant that there are difficulties in exposing scandals in a timely and sufficiently detailed way.
Two that you looked at were Benghazi next to what happened with 9/11. And 9/11 hardly got any scandal-type coverage, whereas Benghazi did. How do you explain that?
That's my most recent research on scandals. And I was struck by how much attention was given to Benghazi, where four Americans tragically died. And it certainly can be argued that the person in charge of the State Department, who's Hillary Clinton, bore some responsibility for that. However, the amount of attention to Clinton's Benghazi responsibility, the many hearings and coverage of this issue, it struck me that I don't remember the last time there was a really large attack by terrorists on American citizens. We call it September 11th. Obviously, it got enormous media attention, but not as a scandal. And the key thing here is that we have enormous evidence that George W. Bush was given numerous specific warnings about impending major terrorist attacks on 9/11. You know, the one memo that's been publicized is the one that says Bin Laden determined to attack the United States. That was only one of many briefings he and his top people were given. They did essentially nothing, although I'm not saying he could have possibly prevented the 9/11 attacks. The fact that he did nothing to prevent them could easily have been quite a big scandal. And so what my research shows is that there's very little attention to the potential scandalous irresponsibility of the Bush administration and not doing anything about the 9/11 attack, compared to the enormous scandalized attention Clinton and to some extent Obama got over the deaths of four unfortunate Americans in Benghazi. And that seems to me an excellent illustration of the very phenomena that I've been talking about scandals not being calibrated to how serious they are, and the public really not finding out about many serious scandals.
Let's talk about why that is. One reason you were pointing to in your book is that the party that should be talking about it is not really talking about it in the terms that it should.
Actually, a terrific illustration is this comparison, because I think most listeners will remember that the Republican Party attempted to make Benghazi a scandal no matter how many times they could fail to find any evidence that there's a scandal there, nonetheless, there's yet another investigation by yet another congressional committee. And even when Republican-headed committees vote reports finding no evidence for any wrongdoing by Hillary Clinton, or perhaps minor wrongdoing, that was not enough. They kept it in the news. And that ultimately led to the discovery of the email situation, which was then, of course, became even bigger than Benghazi. And, you know, there's some evidence now that it was email that undid Clinton's campaign and therefore made Trump president. So this whole Benghazi scandal is quite an important thing, and it could be traced to Republicans' absolute determination to make this a scandal. That contrasts so clearly, and in the paper I give some examples, where Democrats absolutely avoided opportunities to turn Bush's treatment of the 9/11 warnings into scandal. Instead, they acquiesced in turning their attention to other matters, as did the media. Now, it is true that the Bush administration was, I have to say, quite brilliant at orchestrating media coverage so that the question of Bush's responsibility was only occasionally mentioned and quickly was moved on to something else.
I assume in that case, in 9/11, there were a couple of things going on. One is what you called a cover-up in your book. But the second thing is also the Democrats' fear of being labeled as a group that would politicize a national tragedy.
Yes, and I think that fear is somewhat justified. But of course, it leads us to the paradox that if a president makes an enormous mistake like 9/11, like allowing the 9/11 attacks and doing nothing about them, you can't criticize. If the president and secretary of state, and I should have said the secretary of state and national security advisor, were also culpable in the 9/11 attacks because they're the president's top advisors. In this case, granting that Obama and Clinton deserve some criticism for Benghazi, so that becomes the big scandal because it isn't a huge national tragedy. But the huge national tragedy, they get a pass. That may be a partial explanation, but I always like to say to people, do a mental experiment. What if Al Gore had actually entered the White House and the Republicans found out that he had ignored and his top people had ignored numerous warnings from their terrorism experts in the White House and in the State Department and in the CIA? The head of the CIA says before 9/11, they were pulling their hair out that they couldn't get the president and his people to focus on this danger. If the Republicans had been the opposition and Gore had been president, I think most people would agree that the party that was able to make Benghazi a four-year scandal would have found a way to make that negligence of the 9/11 warnings a major scandal. And they wouldn't have been scared of being attacked for politicizing something.
Then, of course, you've got the email so-called scandals, where Hillary Clinton had a server in her house. But there were some comparable things that went on during the Bush administration, weren't there?
Yes. Colin Powell actually, apparently, according to Clinton, recommended to her that she use a private email account. I don't know if he recommended the private server, but really, the server's not all that relevant. The point is that the scandal, allegedly, was that she exposed national security issues by using this private email. Might have been less secure. Powell used private email that might have been less secure. He destroyed most of his emails before they could be investigated. Therefore, we don't know how many exposed potentially classified information. Furthermore, the Bush administration destroyed close to 2 million emails by a bunch of Bush administration people. In the face of investigations, particularly involving Alberto Gonzalez, the former attorney general, and his illegal firings of some U.S. district attorneys. But the point is, again, the actual behavior matters less than the skill at politicizing and framing as scandalous. And the mainstream media are really vulnerable to manipulation on this score.
I think that new media plays into this. You're talking about mainstream media being vulnerable to the manipulation by the framing and attacks They seem to just repeat what comes out in some of these social media, which then exacerbates the problem.
Now it's sort of a two-pronged attack that a party that's clever at manipulating the mainstream media can also have allies and also professionals who are helping them in the social media. And I would say 2016 does mark, aside from the whole Trump campaign itself, the other big thing that happened this year is the rise of social media and fake news transmitted by social media and websites. I was just reading some truly remarkable things about the sharing of fake news stories. My favorite one is that the Pope endorsed Donald Trump, which is like hard to believe, but nonetheless, this was shared a million times, far more than any other true story. In fact, at least according to my reading of one study by BuzzFeed, in most cases, the most shared stories were fake. And we're talking about billions of shares and who knows how many, you know, visual impressions and how many people heard about these things. And this is different from the past. In the past, there could be rumors, but you actually had to like call up a friend and tell them this or write them a letter or in more recent years, send an email to a bunch of your friends. Now we're talking about this essentially broadcasting stuff. And, you know, when you add that to stuff that isn't fake, like the endorsement of Trump by the Pope, but there are other things that at least have a grain of truth. Let's say it's the Benghazi stuff. You know, people will share that over and over and over again, and that occupies their mind. And so what I consider to be a strange situation, like Trump being rated as more honest than Clinton. Strange because, you know, you can say a lot of things about Trump, but his record of dishonesty as a businessman is about as clear as any businessman in the history of the United States.
One of the things that seems to have arisen with this fake news is that there are these websites that promulgate this fake news that are in other countries, and they just make stuff up. And because it attracts money, they just keep doing it. So it's a little bit like the economic model completely gone awry.
Yes. It's interesting because our theory of the marketplace of ideas allied to the actual economic marketplace, there's an assumption that the demand will be for true news. And what we know about market economics is, well, but if the demand for the fake news is high, the market will respond and we'll get lots of fake news. And that's the genius of the market. The problem is that isn't quite what the idea of the founders were, I don't think, in promulgating the First Amendment. You know, both Facebook and Twitter, I guess, have talked about changing their algorithms to allow some forms of filtering of things that are obviously fake. But of course, there are many other cases where we're not talking about completely fabricated, but sort of one-tenth truths. And, you know, who are we going to vest with the power to censor that stuff? It's very tricky.
With the rise of fake news and the rise of social media, there's also simultaneously been such a discrediting of fact checkers and of anything establishment. People distrust these types of organizations that are actually trying to sift out the fact from fiction.
For many years, there's been a media literacy movement among educators, and I think it's now become more important than ever. And it has to include not merely how to read a newspaper now, but how to recognize that if you're seeing something just because it's on the web, in fact, maybe because it's on the web, you should be more suspicious. But it does speak, I think it speaks to two other things. Number one, one of our major political parties has proclaimed really that it's okay not to listen to scientific evidence and that kind of thing when it comes to climate change and when it comes to, let's say, President Obama's place of birth. This is very damaging. I mean, apart from its partisan, you know, and my partisan feelings or whatever, it's a very damaging lesson to our citizens that it's okay to, you know, just go with your gut. That's a problem. A second problem is there has been a decline in support for public education. Although our citizenry has more degrees than ever before, I'm not sure they're actually as well educated as they used to be. And I think that speaks to the lack of critical thinking skills that should enable people to reject some of the falsehoods.
I know you've also studied how race has come into this particular election and how we have been seeing race portrayed in mass media.
It's complicated because I think there's been, in the last couple of years, I think a lot of white people have learned something new about the police's treatment of particularly black people. And this is stuff that wasn't well known, I think, before among whites, and that has given a basis for some sympathy. On the other hand, it's clear from the success of Trump's campaign and many of his supporters and his willingness to name an outright racist and anti-Semite to be his top political advisor, that the white population of the United States, and this is not surprising, still doesn't have a great contextual understanding of the fact that racial discrimination still affects the lives of most black people. And so they don't have the sympathy and empathy that I think they could have if they knew more.
Robert Entman, it's always a pleasure to host you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Robert Entman is professor of media and public affairs and professor of international affairs at the George Washington University. He is the author of Scandal and Silence, Media Responses to Presidential Misconduct, Projections of Power, Framing News, Public Opinion in U.S. Foreign Policy, and The Black Image in the White Mind, Media and Race in America. When we come back, what will the 2016 election really bring in terms of policy and governance? Stay tuned.
That the dice are loaded, everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Will the 2016 election have big consequences for the U.S. and for the world? Three experts join us now. Sean Theriault is professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of The Gingrich Senators, The Roots of Partisan Warfare in Congress, The Power of the People, Congressional Competition, Public Attention and Voter Attribution, and Party Polarization in Congress. William Grover also joins us. He's a professor of political science at St. Michael's College. He is the co-author of The Unsustainable Presidency, Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Beyond, and the author of The President as Prisoner, a Structural Critique of the Carter and Reagan Years. Keith Poole joins us. He's a professor of the Department of Political Science at the University of Georgia and professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the co-author of Political Bubbles, Financial Crises, and the Failure of American Democracy, as well as Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches. Well, thank you for joining us here on the Scholars Circle once again. It's great to have the three of you back with us. So the big questions: what does this 2016 election mean for us, both in terms of what does it say about where we are in the United States politically, but then also what does it mean for policy from here forward? Sean Theriault, I'm going to have you start. Perhaps we should start with what does this mean about the United States as a country?
Well, what the election means about the United States as a country is just that we're pretty equally divided. And so even with these massive personalities running at the top of the ticket, in the end, we end up deciding as a country just as we would have had we done it strictly based on our own partisanship. And so there was very little crossover as it ended up turning out. And there was very little split ticket voting. So you had people just marching into the ballot box and casting pretty consistent Republican votes all the way down or Democratic votes all the way down.
I agree with what Sean said. One of the things that the overreaction to all this, I'm old. I was in the Vietnam War, and I remember the 1960s really well. And there's a tendency to overreact to these things. We have to wait for at least a while before we actually even know what the total turnout was. It looks like it's slightly down, but I think what's unusual about this election that we'll have to spend some time on at some point as researchers is the switch of Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan into the Republican column, and what that says about the level of inequality in the United States and how angry people are. I think the elites missed that completely. And if you look at the county level voting around Pittsburgh, where my wife and I spent 19 years, and into Southern Ohio, which is ground zero for the oxycodone epidemic, which is documented in Dreamland, a great book. There's more than just sort of the usual epithets thrown here. Some of what happened here was a reaction to the fact that the median family income, the lower 40% of the population, has not moved in 40 years, and throw the bums out. But beyond that, I wouldn't turn this into some sort of cosmic event.
Bill Grover.
I agree with both of them, but I would say that in the climate of fear and anger that pervades the country, when you have structurally a two-party system, you've got somebody who said he's going to shake things up, and you have Hillary, who's kind of the human embodiment of the status quo, or the elite, if you will. And so given a two-party system, it makes some sense, and I put that word in quotation marks, it makes some sense that people would vote for the guy who says he's going to shake things up and going to drain the swamp. You know, I think that makes some sense given the system we have now. But a lot of fear, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of anger. It may or may not be an earth-shattering election. We'll have to see. You know, we read the tea leaves in terms of the 11-week transition period and who he's going to pick for certain positions. We can kind of read those tea leaves, but we don't really know until things kick in and policy starts happening. To me, it's definitely true that neither party is really addressing what leads to underlying fear, that underlying uncertainty, that underlying economic dislocation. There's really neither party is speaking to that. But in a two-party system, when you have one candidate who embodies, you know, the establishment, then it makes some sense to vote for the other guy, you know?
Even when the other guy really is still part of the establishment, just not the political establishment. He's part of the corporate establishment, which has been sort of in lockstep with the political establishment. Go ahead, Sean.
Except that I'm not sure that Donald Trump was ever really part of the New York Wall Street business establishment. I mean, I think even folks in New York viewed him as a little bit outside of their normal operating circles.
But that's true.
But clearly a man of business.
That's true. And he's been a celebrity for a long, long time. It's a very unusual election. And I think what's come out in the last week, I think it's pretty clear that the Trump people didn't think they were going to win. And it was Kellyanne Conway, who is really smart person, started picking up stuff in polling in Pennsylvania and Michigan. And that's why they moved all those assets there. And clearly the Clinton people picked it up too, or they wouldn't have rushed up there and done those big events. I think it's going to be a while before we have, you know, the information we need to kind of figure out exactly how this shook out. But it's Grover, right? I agree. You know, I think you're exactly right. I mean, if you go back and look since President Obama was elected, right, you had President Obama was essentially a throw the bums out type election. Actually, it was one before that, 2006. And then 2010 was another throw the bums out. And 2014 was another throw the bums out. So I don't think Trump has a lot of time to deliver on promises before we get another throw the bums out in 2018.
Well, that actually brings up one of Bill Grover's arguments, which is really that the president tends to deliver continuity more than change. Bill Grover, why don't you just give us a thumbnail sketch of why you think that is?
I'm not saying that it doesn't make a difference who's elected. It does make a difference. For example, if the issues that are nearest and dearest to your heart have the LGBT issues, then of course it makes a difference to have a Democrat in the White House over a Republican. But the modern presidency was built on certain assumptions about economic growth, endless economic growth, and certain assumptions about national security and in the pursuit of U.S. objectives and foreign policy. And that notion of economic growth and that notion of national security, really, there's a bipartisan elite consensus about those as goals. And so I think one of the reasons why people are quadrennially perplexed why things don't change is because the two parties represent basically that elite consensus with some differences around the edges, except on some social hot button issues. And so I think that's why we get more continuity than change, because even Bernie Sanders, who I supported and who was farther to the left than any candidate we've had in a long, long time, was probably not willing to challenge as much as he would like to the notion of economic growth and the notion of national security. So I think that it's hard to get a fundamental disagreement over those basics. But in a world of climate change and in a world of declining U.S. power and U.S. hegemony, we need to redefine those terms, but we're not going to get that redefinition from Trump or from Clinton. At least I don't think we will.
In fact, my concern is one of Trump's promises, which was to dismantle things like the EPA and to dismantle or at least withdraw from the agreements, the Paris agreements, the climate agreements. And so it's quite possible that we end up with kind of bigger problems as with that connection. Where do we go with issues related to the environment and climate? How do you see it coming out, Bill Grover?
Well, I mean, first of all, as I was saying to my students today, it's kind of mind-boggling. If you wrote this in a novel, nobody would believe you, but it's kind of mind-boggling that for the last 18 months, neither Hillary Clinton nor Donald Trump, nor any of the others, perhaps a little bit with Bernie, but to take the two major candidates, for the last 6 or 7 months when they've just been in the driver's seat, climate change almost literally didn't come up as an issue. So where it's going to go with Donald Trump is probably nowhere, as you suggested, dismantling regulations, tax cuts for industries in the alleged aim of promoting jobs and creating jobs, lifting the president's temporary block on the Dakota Access Pipeline and more and more fossil fuel production. And when it comes to climate change, it seems to me that it doesn't take a genius or even a political scientist to see that for the next 4 years, the problems are going to be exacerbated. They're not going to be improved. And if we go above 2 degrees Celsius, which we're headed toward, global average temperature climb, we're in some serious trouble. And the Republicans just elected, or the nation just elected a person who wants us to run toward the edge of the cliff faster.
Sean Theriault, how do you see this shaping?
Right, so I don't disagree with what Bill said, but I would refer back to his earlier comments about the continuity that presidents provide by pursuing economic growth and basic military policy. And I think that we've seen Trump kind of, right, for as outsider as he was and as iconoclastic as he was, in the last week and a couple of days, he's indicated that he's buying in a little bit to that continuity. So I'm not entirely certain at all that anything that he said on the campaign trail is going to be reality once he takes office. And what's been particularly interesting on this climate issue, particularly where I am here in Texas, is that I've seen companies who we would normally think of as being a little bit hostile to climate change arguments and in pursuit of job growth have come out pretty strongly that we need to maintain our world-leading status as being on the forefront of the climate debate and stuff like that. I mean, even ExxonMobil had their government person out with a report saying that they're hopeful and they're going to encourage President Trump to maintain our commitment to addressing climate change issues.
Keith Poole, how do you see it?
Two things. One, the coal-fired plants are rapidly headed downhill. We're going to be gone anyway because the executives have figured out that coal was just simply going to be too expensive in the sense of trying to capture CO2. And so I expect a more friendly administration towards fracking, especially for natural gas, because natural gas basically is already replacing coal at a rapid rate. And there is a consensus, I believe, that we ought to speed up the construction of nuclear power plants, since that technology has gotten much safer. If I can address the military policy, I have a relative, and I won't give any more information other than that, that spent 4 years in Iraq and is very pro-Trump solely on the basis that he thinks that that was $6 trillion down a rat hole and doesn't want anything to do with any more wars in the Middle East. And I can say as a Vietnam veteran that was, I don't know how many equivalent $1 trillion down a rat hole as well. So I don't expect Trump to, he'll lose a lot of support from a lot of people if he takes a neocon approach to basically intervening in other countries' affairs. That's why I'm kind of sitting and waiting to see what he does on the Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State, because he made a pretty strong promise on those grounds, namely no more of these wasteful foreign adventures. In that sense, he may be breaking the mold here and have that and the infrastructure, I think, have a lot of cross-party appeal. So, you know, as a friend of mine says, let's wait and see for a few months what these appointees are.
Bill Grover, what about the foreign policy end of it that Keith is talking about?
Candidate Trump did make some overtures toward questioning the reliance of NATO and the funding of NATO and questioning things like Clinton's plan to, you know, have a no-fly zone over Syria. So there's some individual points where candidate Trump was stepped outside the mold a little bit, but I don't think in terms of the kind of elite foreign policy council on foreign relations kind of consensus that the U.S. should lead the world and that the U.S. should that our dominance of the world is necessary to maintain world order. I don't think he's going to challenge that at all. He's going to make America great again. He's going to make America central in the world. He may question, like he did, nibble around the edges of questioning how reliable NATO is, but I don't think he's going to challenge that consensus at all. I mean, and as for getting back to Sean's point, I know that you know, ExxonMobil will occasionally make some noises about the need to continue to explore alternative energy. Under President Trump, it looks to me like he's been calling for a rapid increase in the use of fossil fuels and fracking and coal and all the rest. And so it seems to me that given the nature of the climate change crisis right now, he's going to just make that worse. I can't see – it's true that occasionally you get some nice words out of the fossil fuel industry, but, I mean, they lied for more than 30 years about climate change, and we now know that with documents. It's true that occasionally they'll say something that mollifies people who believe in climate change, but I can't see that that's going to make any huge difference in terms of us leaving those fossil fuels in the ground, which is where I think they need to stay if we're going to have a chance.
One of the other issues that has come up, actually mainly from Paul Ryan, is privatization of some of the medical services that are now provided by the government, like Medicare. And so if that is something that the Republican establishment wants, is it something that we see happening in the coming 4 years? Sean Thurio?
It depends a lot on what the Republicans do with the filibuster in the Senate. Clearly, a proposal like that is not going to have much support at all in the Democratic Party. And so if we still operate in the 60-vote Senate, then they're going to need 8 Democrats to even entertain that notion before it would have any play whatsoever. So unless if the Republicans are ready to change the rules in the Senate so that it only requires a majority vote, then I just can't imagine that's going to have much legs. And even within the Republican Party, I think that Susan Collins would have a hard time with that.
She would.
I suspect that there may be a few other Republicans who would view that idea pretty skeptically. But nonetheless, like I applaud them for at least now at this point having a real debate about policies. I mean, something that's been utterly lacking in our political discourse over the last 6 months when we've been talking about crazy emails and Benghazi and live hate and what you can do when you're a powerful man. I mean, it's nice that we're actually back down to policy so we can at least engage some of those big problems that we're facing.
I'm 100% disabled due to exposure to Agent Orange. And so I'm not only disabled with multiple myeloma, but I also have another serious problem that my oncologist is trying to figure out. So I know the medical system firsthand. Privatization is not going to happen. Nothing like that's going to happen. And Medicare and Medicaid are too tightly intertwined with the ACA, which desperately needs to be fixed, that you're going to have to go very slowly, especially since President-elect Trump has come out and backed the two most popular pieces, namely, you know, you can't stop people from getting insurance because of pre-existing conditions and up to 26-year-old women or parents. But the problem is that, you know, with healthcare, people will spend an infinite amount of other people's money to stay alive. And I know everybody likes to make fun of good old Sarah Palin, but, she, you know, basically you got to have death panels in some form or other because it says at some point they're going to have to say to me, well, you know, we just can't keep you alive any longer. So the Republicans are going to be very shy, I think, about they're going to move really slowly on this because it's such an intertwined system that you can't just sort of pull on a thread. But one of the things I hope happens is that we finally pass a bill with teeth, because the VA is as bad as you read in the papers. It really is. It's a horror show, I know from personal experience, and it needs to be fixed. And hopefully that's one of the things that will come out of this.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and we're talking about the ramifications coming from the 2016 election on policy and governance. Keith Poole, I wanted to also ask you about the political bubbles idea. It was one of my favorite books that you co-wrote. And this was a book that examined the economic bubble and the economic collapse that we witnessed through the eyes of the policies that enabled them. How do you see us moving forward on this front with a Congress essentially dominated by Republicans and Donald Trump in the White House?
Well, they probably won't do too much except for making the Consumer Finance Agency actually have a board, just like any other regulatory agency, accountable to Congress. There's another area where it's so complicated. If we were going to do meaningful reform, as we talk about at the end, last chapter of Political Bubbles, namely actually reinstate a strong form of Glass-Steagall, that is gone, and the banks are bigger than ever, and they're actually not loaning money that much. That's one of the reasons why Quicken has suddenly become a mortgage lender. So I don't expect much to happen on that, except for the Consumer Finance Agency. I think there are bigger fish that they have to fry first.
One of the press headlines that I've been seeing a lot of deals with cutting the regulations related to business. And this is why I was asking, and that may include things like Dodd-Frank, and I don't know how you feel about unwinding Dodd-Frank, but that is one of the things that is ostensibly on the table.
Dodd-Frank basically is so complex and it creates so many information asymmetries in terms of the regulated versus the regulators. That is just a huge rambling mess. And I think Republicans would be foolish to repeal it. But on the other hand, I would like to see, that's why I was myself, I would have voted for Bernie if he would have gotten the nomination. Because I detest the banks. Since you've read my book with Howard Nolan, you know, at the end of that book, we just simply lay waste to the elites that brought this about. And I'd like to see Glass-Steagall reinstated, but the Republicans aren't going to do it. I think we're going to see just simply a continuation of the status quo.
Could I jump in, Maria?
Yes, please. Bill Grover.
I think Keith is right. Medicare and Medicaid and the ACA are intimately interconnected. They're entwined together. But I think when I go back to one of Sean's points, one of the things that's going to be really telling this January is whether, as he suggested, whether the Republicans in the Senate are willing to do away with Rule 22 and bring cloture down from 60 to 51 votes, the nuclear option or some version of the nuclear option. If that happens, that would have to happen fairly soon. That would be a pretty strong early signal that the Republicans in the House and Senate, particularly in the Senate, are interested in really going far and attacking the Affordable Care Act, even though it is a very, very, very complex piece of legislation, going forward and trying to get rid of Dodd-Frank, trying to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. Trump, during the campaign, made some noises kind of as if he wished Glass-Steagall would be reinstated. It's hard to know what Trump... Actually, we really know extraordinarily little about what his core values are besides the fact that he likes to make money. We don't know a heck of a lot. I suppose one of the rays of hope would be that he doesn't follow the trajectory of the logic of his language, and in fact, maybe he'll be more open because he has, I think, really very few core principles. He may be open to a lot of pressure to keep these pieces of the Affordable Care Act in place and things like that. So I think there may be actually more pressure from him, from House and Senate conservatives, to stick to his rhetoric more than the pressure that would come from him himself. I mean, I think that he is an open book, but I think we'll know more by what the Senate does or does not do with their own rules fairly early in the ballgame, and that will tell us a heck of a lot.
Let's also talk about appointments. I know that President Obama tried to make some appointments and was blocked, particularly on the Supreme Court, but others as well. Those vacancies, I assume, will now get filled by a new president with obvious majorities in the Senate to approve them. Do we have any sense so far about what, based on who he's appointing to the transition team or some of the names that are circulating, do we have any sense of what might happen there, Sean Thurial?
I think the only thing we really know by reading the tea leaves of the transition team is that anyone associated with Chris Christie is out. but beyond that...
Thanks to Jared Kushner,
Right. But everyone else, I mean, he has establishment Republicans. He has people from the Republican fringes. He has business people. You can't tea leave much about a direction whatsoever. And then when you see the folks that he's interviewing, I mean, for some of these positions, he's interviewing people who are diametrically opposed within the Republican Party for some of these positions. So has a pretty broad sweep right now. And until he starts making decisions and pointing fingers at people and saying you're hired, I don't think we'll be able to tease much about what a Trump administration is going to do.
A lot of the Democrats are going to rue the day that they allowed Harry Reid to get rid of the 60 votes just to get three judges on the D.C. Court of Appeals, because that means that in terms of appointments to the cabinet, executive agencies, and so on, you just need 51 votes. With a 52-seat majority, that means, you know, people like Rand Paul, who's already grouched about Rudy Giuliani and John Bolton. Trump is advocating a lot of things that the Democrats like. And he and Minority Leader Schumer come out of the same sort of, you know, Manhattanites, have known each other for at least 20 years or more, and know about Babe Davis Bacon and, you know, what it takes to do construction in Manhattan. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's a lot of deals that can be made there. And I'm kind of dubious whether or not the Republicans might change the rule, but only for Supreme Court appointments, because that would be toxic to try to go in and they can do a lot with the ACA, for example, with reconciliation. But sounds to me like we all agree that the healthcare is so complex, and we do need to move. Even if Hillary Clinton would have won as expected, there was big trouble out there, and they would have had to have revisited the issue if she had been elected in any event. So let's wait and see.
Bill Grover.
Last night when Bernie Sanders spoke at George Washington, he talked about some of the areas where there might be some progressive agreement with President Trump, and one of them was what Keith mentioned, but also on an infrastructure bill, too. And his point was last night that those on the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and liberals in general should keep Trump's feet to the fire when it comes to some of those kinds of projects and see if we can really some support for maybe not a $15 an hour minimum wage, but maybe raising the minimum wage to $10 an hour. So we should keep pressure on him for that and keep pressure on him for an infrastructure project. So there might be some possibilities for common grounds. And I think Keith is right. It would be toxic to lower the filibuster from 60 to 51. It would also be short-sighted because they'll be in the minority someday themselves and wish they had it. So I'm not saying they're going to do that, but that'll be one early sign about how aggressive I think they're going to be.
Sean Thurial?
If I might just add, not only would it be toxic, but it would get rid of the last excuse the Republicans could have for why they didn't implement all of Trump's ideas. So long as there's a filibuster in the Senate, right, the Democrats have to share somewhat in responsibility of governing. But if they get rid of that, then there's nothing stopping Republicans from solving all these problems that Donald Trump said he alone could fix.
They do have a bit of a history, particularly under Newt Gingrich, though, of overplaying their hand. So you're right, they probably won't do it, but it wouldn't be unthinkable since this may be perceived by them to be their moment, you know, where they've got all three branches of government and it's their moment. You know?
There are a lot of Republican senators who've been around a while who'd never go along with any more of these rules changes, one of them being John McCain. And enough of them have a memory about how much trouble they got into back in the 90s during that idiotic impeachment of President Clinton. And I think they will move slowly on this stuff just because of that. And along with Bill's point, you know, I think there's a deal there, a really good deal that could be made on infrastructure. Go for $1 trillion. I'd go for $3 trillion, but, you know, I'm not running the world. $1 trillion in exchange for raising the minimum wage in exchange, throw in the usual sweeteners for small business. And then almost everybody agrees that the corporate tax structure is a mess and that could be fixed and all that money repatriated back into the United States. So there's a lot of wiggle room there to make a deal, I think. And I would expect an infrastructure deal to be made for the simple reason there are all these unemployed men out there, blue collar workers, and you basically require, right, U.S. rebar and U.S. concrete and Davis-Bacon wages. You got a deal.
Doesn't it seem like when a Democrat is in the presidency that the Republicans act like obstructionists, but now that they will have a Republican in the presidency, that they will cooperate and the Democrats will cooperate no matter what? Is that just a perception or is there reality to that?
It seems to me, Maria, that someone should write a book about how Republicans are obstructionists.
Huh. And I heard this.
Tom Inn and Norman Ornstein wrote that book a few years ago. It's even worse than it looks. They wrote that book.
Simple answer to your question is that I think that at the end of the day, the Democrats are the party of government. And so for them to employ the same type of obstructionist tactics that the Republicans do, then it ultimately, it doesn't serve their long-term interest of showing the government as being capable of solving problems. And so Republicans, of course, are not the party of government. So when they can't control the levers of government and they're in the minority, then it serves their interest to show how bad government is at solving problems. So it's not that the Democrats are better or they're less mean or anything like that. It's just that it serves their long-term interest to show that the government can function.
Let's just say a little bit about polarization. Are we becoming more polarized or less polarized?
It's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out. And it depends, again, on a lot of what a Trump presidency looks like. Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are suggesting that there's an entire agenda on which they could agree with Donald Trump. It would suggest that perhaps polarization is going to be a bit weakened. So it depends how much Donald Trump is driving the legislative agenda or how much Mike Pence is. Because there's no doubt if Mike Pence is pulling the string that we're going to have polarization off the chart. But if Donald Trump is talking about raising a minimum wage and a big infrastructure program, and if, as Keith suggests, that there might be some wiggle room on corporate tax solution, then we might have a little bit of a reprieve. At this point, it's a little bit pie in the sky to even suggest that. It certainly is much more likely than if Hillary Clinton had won the presidency, because the Republicans just digging in their heels and saying no to absolutely everything. And so if we're looking for silver linings, perhaps that's one of them.
This period of polarization now has been going on since the 1970s, and what goes up must come down. We're equally polarized around the turn of the 20th century, in other words, around 1900 to 1908, and that eventually cooled off. It's possible that could happen this time, simply because, again, to go back to military policy, there aren't too many people out there who think Iraq was a really good idea. And in terms of trying to do something about a healthcare system, there's a pretty broad agreement that we've got to go in and fix some of the obvious flaws in the ACA. And in terms of taxes, I think you're not going to go back to the simplified tax system of 1986, Bradley-Reagan system, but there's a pretty good argument to be made that you could do some really good deals there in terms of simplifying the tax system, especially the corporate, but also the individual, in exchange for some sorts of fixes on the entitlements. So I'm not completely bleak. I think that the two political parties have become so dysfunctional and their underlying bases have become so strange that something was going to blow up eventually, and maybe we'll finally see things cool off, I hope.
Well, I think it's interesting that we're talking about how polarized the political system is, and then we just saw a campaign from Donald Trump where the polarization reached, you know, a crescendo against Muslims and Mexicans and gays and women and all the rest of it. And so it's striking to me how quickly the pundits, the media pundits and other politicians and commentators are looking for this common ground when we just came through a campaign that was just incredibly polarized and incredibly negative. And the kind of Trump characterization of the world was extremely stark. I mean, he looked out at the world and he saw, you know, horror everywhere he looked. And now, you know, a couple of weeks later, we're trying to find the pieces of common ground. We're trying to find the things he said in the past, like maybe he could go for Glass-Steagall, maybe he could go for a $10 minimum wage, where it's interesting to watch the system itself look to normalize Trump, look for the common ground that we might be able to make with Trump. It's interesting to see that happen when we just came through really the worst campaign since I've been following campaigns in 1972.
Do you agree, Sean Theriault?
It's hard to say. I think that it's not only that the pundits and the system is trying to normalize Donald Trump, but I think Donald Trump is trying to normalize Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And so I think that he viewed campaigning utterly separate from the way that he views governing. So campaigning was all about winning. And then once the winning was done, he's like, all right, now I need to be a success.
Right.
And if he recognizes that the promises that he made on the trail aren't going to help him be a success, then he'll discard them. Going back to Bill's earlier point, like it's so unclear what his core is, either like morally, ethically, or even policy-wise.
Building a wall is a policy. Excoriating immigrants is an attitude. And I think that they're, you know, that attitude that Mexicans are to blame for things and that Muslims are to blame for things. I worry about that attitude. That attitude will linger, even though on this or that policy area, he might, you know, un-Trump himself and sound a little bit more reasonable. But I still worry that on some policies, he's going to have those gut instincts that are still quite dangerous.
I suspect that message resonates among his supporters more than it's going to resonate with him. We'll know soon enough, but it's clearly resonated with his supporters.
Thank you, all three of you, for joining us again on the Scholar Circle. Pleasure to have all three of you again.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Maria.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
Sean Theriault is professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of The Gingrich Senators, The Roots of Partisan Warfare in Congress, The Power of the People, Congressional Competition, Public Attention and Voter Attribution, and Party Polarization in Congress. William Grover is a professor of political science at St. Michael's College. He is the co-author of The Unsustainable Presidency, Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Beyond, and the author of The President as Prisoner, A Structural Critique of the Carter and Reagan Years. Keith Poole is a professor of the Department of Political Science at the University of Georgia and professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the co-author of Political Bubbles, Financial Crises, and the Failure of American Democracy, as well as Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.